88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. RAD is the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program. Has it brought much-needed funds into the city's rundown public housing, or does it represent a shift in how public housing, which has been around since the 1930s, is run? Producer John McCone explores what's at stake. Then a conversation with the designer Ellen Lupton. Her latest book, Beautiful Users, chronicles how the focus of design has shifted from the products themselves to the people who use them. She'll explain how design affects everything from how we peel potatoes to how we talk on the phone. Then the Everyman Theater's resident dialects coach Gary Logan tells us about how he's trained the Everyman actors to sound authentically Irish in their production of Outside Mullingar. And the Baltimore-based writer David Grimm on his book Citizen Canine, how the status of animals in our homes and in our society has evolved over time. First, the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. In public housing, a program called Rental Assistance Demonstration aspires to create a stable source of funding to help private owners repair and maintain public housing units. RAD's proponents say it will spark long overdue investment by private developers in underfunded public housing, but critics say it will let private businesses control a federal program that should remain publicly funded. Johnna McCone has been following changes to Baltimore's public housing. She brings us the story.
We're standing here at McCullough Homes. It was actually one of the first public housing developments that was erected by the Housing Authority at the time.
Lawrence Brown is a professor at Morgan State University. He studies how disinvestment and segregation affect health. In short, how policies in the past shape the Baltimore of today.
McCullough Homes function as a buffer between, to our west, what would have been Black Baltimore at the time, and to our east, across State Center, there's the Bolton Hill community, which is white. And so by placing this here, it basically said we're going to do everything in our power to keep a divider between. So this would be a Black community, and that's going to stay a white community.
Public housing was created in 1937. In the quarter century that followed, millions of African Americans left rural areas, and cities became more segregated. Housing projects were often built adjoining those segregated communities. Susan Popkin is a researcher at the Urban Institute. She's written several books on public housing. She says even though housing projects displaced people from slums and tenements, many were delighted by the new accommodations.
It was so much better than what they had before. They had a shower, they had a bathtub, you know, they had electric lights. And as bad as it looks to us from this vantage point, you have to think about where people were starting.
To hold down costs, housing projects were big. They housed huge numbers of people. Many communities were isolated and segregated by highways, and over time, residents included fewer working families and more of the very poorest. By the 90s, the aging buildings had deteriorated.
Public housing, you know, quote unquote, failed in a very public way, and they needed to come up with a solution that addressed the problem in a very visible way.
Eva Rosen is a sociologist and postdoctoral fellow at Harvard.
We could see the violence across the country in these poor neighborhoods. We saw images of police trying to go into these developments and deal with crime. We saw images of just the state of the apartments on the inside, the holes in the walls, the elevators not working, lights out in the stairways. And these are problems we still actually hear about.
During the 90s, Baltimore's most troubled and dilapidated high-rises came down. Lawrence Brown says it wasn't just the high-rise model that had failed.
A lot of times they were demolished because the Housing Authority of Baltimore City did not adequately take care of them. They mismanaged funds, they did not fix up public housing, they did not keep it maintained properly.
In the mid-90s, people were transitioned to mixed-income developments, low-rises or the housing voucher program. With vouchers, families pay a portion of their rent to landlords based on their income. HUD covers the rest. Again, Eva Rosen.
So this is a way of relying on housing that already exists in the public market and relying on privately owned properties to house the poor.
Rosen lived in Park Heights for a year starting in 2011. She studied the neighborhood for its mix of homeowners and renters. Rosen found that some landlords are concentrating vouchers in the very neighborhoods the program was designed to get them out of.
they recruit tenants, they select tenants, and they make decisions about who they want to keep. And in particular, it turns out that landlords who have properties in more disadvantaged neighborhoods have a sort of a perverse incentive to attract voucher holders to these neighborhoods.
She says landlords are less likely to rent to voucher holders in more affluent communities because they can easily find tenants to pay those rents. In poorer neighborhoods, landlords are more likely to end up with tenants who struggle to pay rent.
And so if they're able to attract a voucher tenant to this unit, then they're able to collect whatever the housing authority sets that rent at, which tends to be often as much as a couple hundred dollars more a month than they might be able to get from a market tenant. So they're able to get more rent, and they're also able to get the rent that they do get on time.
Housing vouchers represented a new way to house those who need it. Not all Baltimore's housing complexes have been knocked down, though. The city still owns about 22 buildings, many in poor shape. Peter Engel of the Housing Authority oversees the redevelopment of public housing.
The Housing Authority of Baltimore City estimates that we have a backlog of deferred maintenance and capital needs to do roofs, windows, heating systems, all of that sort of capital work. We have a backlog of about $800 million for our roughly 11,000 units.
Under a new program called Rental Assistance Demonstration, or RAD, real estate companies don't just lease to people in their buildings, but actually buy a part of the housing projects. At a meeting in Park Heights last year, Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano told residents the city is in a bind. With the funding that comes out of Washington, it would take 200 years to fix the buildings. He asked the PAC room if they want the 200-year plan or the 2-year plan. Sharon Jones of Bell Park Towers went to the meeting. She plans to keep close track of RAD and question developers' incentives for renovating.
And I know these people want their money back, so what price do we have to pay for them to get their money back?
Peter Engel of the Housing Authority says RAD frees up money unavailable with the traditional housing model by converting public housing subsidies to Section 8 subsidies.
What it allows a housing authority to do is to go to the private sector to borrow funds and to use the low-income housing tax credit program. And both of those programs allow us to bring in a lot of capital to rehab these buildings.
Since the 90s, this public-private model has developed mixed-income communities around the nation. Sociologist Ed Goetz, who wrote New Deal Ruins, says that's a complete rethinking of public housing.
From a design standpoint, from the standpoint of no longer being a public program exclusively, but one that is really focused on attracting private sector investment, it has been driven by this logic of dispersal and deconcentration of poverty, which has justified the demolition of a lot of units of public housing and the loss of that housing stock.
Though RAD won't result in a loss of units, some residents, like Gary Shroud, are concerned about permanent affordability in a city where there are 70,000 on the waiting list for subsidized housing.
We are the backbone of Baltimore! We are the workers!
Shroud led a rally against RAD last year. He lives in Bernard E. Mason's senior apartments in West Baltimore and has been organizing with the Right to Housing Alliance.
And now you want us to live where nobody want to live? We don't think so!
Shroud says the original plan was to sell the land, the building.
The whole 9 yards. We had to speak out. They decided they wouldn't sell the land.
The Homeless Persons Representation Project, other legal groups, residents, and the Housing Authority have been working to negotiate RAD's implementation. Advocates say initial policies would have effectively screened out new residents, who most need the housing subsidy. They've also been looking at other cities rolling out RAD, because even though it's a federal initiative, local housing authorities shape the details of how it happens. Another change hammered out along with residents was leasing the land public housing is on, rather than selling it. As it stands, the Housing Authority has the option to buy the RAD projects back in 15 years when the low-income tax credits expire.
We don't know a lot of things, but HABC will be in the driver's seat because we have the right to buy it back, and that's what's important. So that means at that time, people will be able to evaluate the situation, and if it makes sense for us to buy them back so that we can refinance them again, rehab them again, keep them strong for another 15 or 20 years, I'm sure that's what people will do. If, on the other hand, with the way financing works and the restrictions have all been working and the buildings are still serving the people they're supposed to serve, we'll have that opportunity to keep the development entity or the ownership entity in place, refinance that way, and make sure that they'll continue to be, again, affordable for this very low-income population.
I reached out to a few of the 11 developers listed on the Housing Authority's website. The community builders got back to me but said they can't comment because the contracts are still in negotiation. The unknowns leave many residents worried about the future. A meeting a few weeks ago showed miscommunication between the Resident Advisory Board, the group that communicates with the Housing Authority, and tenants.
And you need to get together with the tenant council, whoever, and get this stuff out. Right and work it out, because I'm not going nowhere.
So there's a lot of misinformation.
That's Gary Shroud from the RAD protest. He helped facilitate the meeting.
When you privatize, you should be able to have a voice in it. You know, the public, the people that it affects should be able to have a voice in it. I'm not organizing a gang to go out here and commit crimes. I'm organizing people to understand where they live, how they live, what they can do to help themselves live better. If you don't know what's going on, you can't help yourself.
Shroud says the Housing Authority has not made it easy to understand the complex changes taking place. He wants people to take more ownership of where they live and not feel intimidated to do so. That's the kind of bottom-up change, he says, that could get people out of poverty long-term. Ed Getz, the sociologist, sees the ambivalence about maintaining public housing as a reflection of racial divides in the U.S.
There was a great deal more support for public housing before it became associated with a quote-unquote welfare-dependent population, before it became associated with largely non-white population. Its stigma is associated with the types of people who are most dependent on public housing. And in most cities, that's people of color and people who have trouble finding a position in the labor force.
Without addressing patterns of racial discrimination, Getz fears public housing will continue to be seen not as a valuable resource,
but rather as something that we'd like to see go away.
For Lawrence Brown of Morgan State, the demolition of public housing paves the way for gentrification.
This is valuable property. It's all about real estate.
We're back at McCullough Homes, where two apartment buildings will be rehabbed through RAD.
This is the first city to sort of employ RAD on such a large level. That's all the remainder of the high-rises in the city. And a lot of them are elders and where seniors live. So in 20 or 30 or 40 years, you won't have a lot of opposition because most of the people that live there won't be alive anymore. No matter what this looks like, you're actually sitting on a gold mine, and you do need to do everything you can to stay where you are and to take control of it if you can.
Brown says he hopes residents can take ownership of the RAD process to win a better affordable housing system, because both the private and the public sector have failed poor African Americans in Baltimore. As the city moves forward with RAD, there's a lot at stake. Is partnering with private entities an investment in public housing's long-term affordability and the communities that depend on it? Or is it another step in the too familiar process of dismantling poor Black communities? I'm Jonna McCone.
And I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us. If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. When we think about design, we tend to think of things that stand apart from us, elegant objects or structures that we admire from a distance for their form and functionality. But for designer Ellen Lupton, design is reflected in mundane objects as well, things we use every day. Ellen is the director of the Graphic Design Masters of Fine Arts program at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's also the senior curator of contemporary design at the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum in New York. Her latest book was a catalog for an exhibition held at the Cooper Hewitt that examined how the design of many of the things we use every day has become more and more user-focused and how that's affecting our daily lives. Her book is called Beautiful Users, Designing for People. When she and I sat down last March to talk about it, I began with the obvious question, if not for people, who else would you design for?
Oh, that's a very good question. You know, a lot of design is created for the designer or for a client that wants to sell something or memorialize something or send a message. Not all design is created primarily with the needs and wishes and experience of the user as the primary purpose. Hmm. And that's a shift and a revolution in design that's taken over the last 40 years or so.
Yeah, so when did that shift start?
Well, one of the pioneers of it is Henry Dreyfuss, who is a great American industrial designer, really helped create the modern profession. And he started asking questions like, why can't we make objects that fit people instead of making people fit objects?
It seems obvious,
right?
Doesn't
it? It does seem obvious, but it isn't and it wasn't. And it is a revolutionary idea.
And it's interesting. So he and a few others really started studying not only human behavior, I mean, how we might use particular objects, but anatomy, literal human anatomy. He invented, along with a fellow named Alvin Tilley, Joe and Josephine, which are sort of generic depictions of the so-called average American body. So what were they looking for when they looked at, quote-unquote, average American bodies in terms of what they were designing for them?
Well, they wanted to see how the things that we use could be scaled in relation to the body. And, of course, this is always an ideal because bodies have huge variation. And designers today recognize that more even than Dreyfuss did. But they wanted to see how can we reshape the world so it better matches the people that use that world. And they did that by observing, by interviewing, by measuring. They really looked at users as the end point mm-hmm. of the design process.
Because you write in the book that we experience design in relation to our own bodies, that it's impossible to not experience the design without the dimension of our own bodies coming into the calculus.
Right, and we tend to think of design as a visual thing and that we buy things based on how they look. But once we start living with something, you're sitting on the chair, you're seeing it with your butt. You're wearing clothes. You're feeling it with your skin. You're not just looking at it. And that's a user experience point of view.
Alan Lupton is my guest. The book is called Beautiful Users, Designing for People on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. I was fascinated that there are these subsects of design, these areas of design. Let me run through them and ask you to give us a little thumbnail of how designers approach things in different ways. One is called universal design. What's that mean?
Universal design is the idea of creating products that as many people as possible can use, and not just the typical Joe and Josephine, but people who fall outside the norm, people with disabilities, elderly people, children, people who have a different physical and mental makeup than your so-called standard. And what designers have found is that by creating products that more people can use, that accommodate and include more people, the experience is better for almost everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's called universal.
Yeah, so finding this ideal, of course, is, you know, inherently problematic because, you know, an adult is going to experience something different than a child, et cetera. Is there such thing as a Joe and Josephine, or Henry Dreyfuss just dreaming there?
I think an example that almost all of us will be familiar with now is the OXO potato peeler. Mm-hmm. And that's a product that was introduced in the early 90s and revolutionized how we experience our kitchen. And if you have ever actually enjoyed peeling a potato, it's probably because you were holding an OXO potato peeler,
which has the spongy plastic rubbery thing.
A thick, chubby handle that was inspired by a bicycle handle, and the designers literally stuck an old-time metal potato peeler inside a bicycle handle to test this idea. And anybody holding it whether it's a kid or me or my mother, is going to have a better experience because it feels better in your hand.
Mm-hmm. And that was animated by the fact that the designer, Sam Farber, is that his name?
Yeah, he's the creator of the company. His wife suffered from rheumatoid arthritis. And I guess he wanted mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
He wanted his wife to peel the potatoes and enjoy it. And in doing so, really changed everything.
That's it. Necessity is the mother of invention. Yeah. And of course, I remember those old metal ones. I mean, you do a few potatoes and you've got blisters on your palms.
And nobody wants to do it. And you might not think about it. You might not go like, I'm not going to peel potatoes today. But that emotion, that emotional resistance is there. And if it feels good in your hand, you're more likely to actually do the task and enjoy it.
Yeah, so that's universal design. What about experience design?
Experience design is the whole notion of thinking about a product or a service as not just the physical artifact, the things that we see, but the whole narrative around doing something. So, for example, airport security is an experience design, right? Someone has had to think through that whole sequence of events and how to make it, you know, as pleasant as possible.
Right. So again, it's
not terribly successful, but that's an example of an experience.
So it's totally opposite the notion that you were talking about before, that we think of design as something you look at. This is something you actually literally have to go through. It's a process.
A narrative that takes place over time.
Right. Experience design. And then how about interaction design? A fellow named Bill Moggridge described it as wearing in instead of wearing out. Interaction design, what does that mean?
Well, interaction design is how we communicate with the products that we use. And a lot of that takes place on computer screens, our phones, but it's your car, right? It's any product that has a complex communication with the user is subject to interaction design. It's really designing that set of exchanges between people and things.
Mm-hmm. And of course, stasis is the last thing that happens in this thing. You're on a computer screen, you tap the screen or you click the mouse and something happens. So it's a new, different thing at every moment.
Right, and it's always branching. The designer has to always imagine, well, what if the user does A, not B? Then what happens? What if the user does it wrong? Right, how do you help the user recover after an error? Right, you don't want just to say fail.
Yeah,
right? You want to bring the user along in an interactive experience.
Yeah, design it despite the user, right? I love how there's this notion that users are a creative force in their own right for some of these designs. And you mentioned Mr. Dreyfus, Henry Dreyfus. He's the guy that designed the telephone in 1937. I mean, I guess this is the iteration of the phone that came right after the vertical spindle where you held the earpiece in one hand and you spoke into the microphone with the other. Mm-hmm. He designed what we know as the sort of desktop telephone. But then in 1953, he redesigned it because he found that the one he designed in 1937 had a sort of fundamental flaw. Explain what happened with that.
Yeah, well, the flaw is really in the receiver. And so his earlier phone is very beautiful. It's a beautiful kind of Art Deco object, a wonderful collector's item. But the receiver has a kind of ridged shape. So if you try to talk on the phone and hold this receiver against your shoulder, let's say you're peeling potatoes and you want to talk on the phone.
You want to have hands free. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that receiver doesn't work because of the ridge sort of triangular profile. Because nobody imagined that people would want to do something else while they were talking on the phone. You know, talking on the phone is supposed to be so exciting and so important that why would you distract yourself with other activities? And this is what happens, is a new product is introduced and designers observe what users actually do. And what they actually want to do is two things at once.
So users have become, you know, in this last 40 or 50 years, you know, front and center in the design process. Is it possible to predict how users are going to change? Because obviously design is going to continue to change and evolve. Can we figure out how we as users are going to be different in 50 years from now?
Well, I think the big thing that's happening now is the rise of customization and the ability for users to ultimately change products to fit their own specific needs. It's kind of the opposite of universal design. Instead of creating one thing that everybody can use, imagine a future where we all get our own potato peeler that's exactly the right size for our hands because it's been printed on demand as it's requested by the user. And that's, you know, where a lot of the future is headed. Yeah.
Ellen Lupton is the director of the Graphic Design Masters of Fine Arts program at the Maryland Institute College of Art and the senior curator of contemporary design at the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum in New York City. She is the author of the catalog for the Cooper Hewitt exhibition that was held last winter called Beautiful Users, Designing for People. We've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead on the program. Stay with us. Outside Mullingar, the new production now running at the Everyman Theater in Baltimore's Bromo Tower Arts and Entertainment District, is a wry romantic comedy by the Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning playwright John Patrick Shanley. You probably know some of his other work. He wrote Doubt. He wrote Moonstruck. Outside Mullingar is set in that celebrated Irish town in a lake-dotted province of Central Ireland. To prepare this production, director Donald Hicken called on the unique talents of Gary Logan, the Everyman's resident dialects coach, to help the American actors learn how to speak like authentic Irish. Gary Logan joined me and Nathan Sterner in Studio A a couple of weeks ago to talk about his work with the cast of the Everyman Theater and his approach to the unique Mullingar accent. Outside Mullingar has an interesting challenge, as I understand it, because it's not just an Irish accent, but it's an accent particular to this particular region of Ireland. Do I have that right?
Yes, that could be said of every single dialect, that dialect or idiolect is specific to that particular place. And it has Irishisms, but they're not the sounds that you'd find in places like Belfast or Donegal or Galway. It's different.
Uh-huh. So let's use Nathan and I as guinea pigs and learn how to sound
You're
Irish.
Making me a guinea pig, too?
That's right. You know, okay. I'm sorry. I'm not going down alone here, Nathan. You're on the ship, baby. You're coming down with me. So you brought in a little a piece of the script from the play. Mm-hmm. It involves two characters, Rosemary and Anthony, and there's a line that you're going to help us learn to say with the proper dialect. The line is, "The problem is there's just not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been."
Right.
So this is something both Nathan and I could probably say, you know, quite credibly, you know,
okay,
accent or not, because
I could say it without accent.
Well, I'd start with the actors this way. I would take them to a particular place in the mouth. So we have, as Americans, kind of an open-throated sound, the way that I'm doing right now. But in this dialect, we want to push everything forward so that you're not using the back of the mouth, you're not opening up the pharynx or anything like that. You're talking in the forward placement of the mouth towards the lips and the teeth. So first of all, that's where we have to start from in terms of where we start the placement of the voice. That's one thing. Then the second
thing. Like the placement of the voice, forward rather than back.
That's right.
Got it.
Then the second two features that we'll talk about today, because there are a million, but there are two important ones in this line, and that is that when we meet a T, the T kind of leaks. It's like a leak from a tire. So it's not just t-t-t, it's t-t-t, has a splash, has a little bit of air behind it. So I would say not, not, not. Will you try that, you guys?
All right, I'll not. Try.
Not.
Not. Not.
Oh, a lot not. More leakage. Not.
Not. Not.
Right, right.
Not.
Right, right.
I have to clean off the microphone after that. Not.
That's right. That's right. There's a little bit of spill there. Then the other thing is in the word theirs. The TH, whether it's voiced or unvoiced, has a particular placement. So if we're gonna do the D, the TH kind of turns into sort of a D. When you make a D, you're using the tip of the tongue, the apical portion of the tongue, along what's called the alveolar ridge. You know that
the back of your upper teeth, right?
Upper teeth, but a little bit behind, where it's sort of a slipping shelf up to the dome of the. That's where T's and D's are made. So if you would just try this and just go da 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 da.
Da 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 da.
Da 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 da.
Great.
Da, 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 da.
Great. Now, in dialects, we can make D's anywhere we want. If I ask you to make a D in the very highest portion of the dome of the hard palate, would you do that? Would you go da 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 da
da da da da
da da da da?
Right, and then we all of a sudden are going subcontinental, kind of where India, right? When we go da da da. Now, if we're going to make that D against the back of the upper incisors, almost in between the teeth, so
like
we're
da 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 da.
Right. So
there's a little more leakage there too.
Yeah, and we say theirs. Would you say theirs?
Theirs.
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 Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's the feeling. So you're using the back teeth as the backboard. The other thing is the music of a dialect. There are different places in Ireland that do different things with the musicality of a line. So, for instance, in Donegal, they might take something and swing it up at the end like that. They'll
swing
take a
it
line
up at the end,
right? But that isn't Westmeath where we are. So we're going to be kind of tumbling down the hill a little bit with the music of the voice. So it's the problem is. Let's try that. The problem is.
The problem is.
That's pretty good.
The problem is.
That's very good. Yeah. The problem is. There's just not enough.
There's just not enough.
That's good.
There's. Oh, I do it for me again. I'm sorry, I lost.
There's just not enough.
There's just not enough.
Very good.
Sounds like Ringo Starr to me. Nathan.
You know,
sounds great, but it sounds like Ringo Starr.
It's funny you say that, because if you look at a map, even though there's water in between them, they're not far away. Uh-huh. And the Liverpudlian dialect has what's called Scouse, which is an Irish influence.
so there's just not enough.
Yeah, there's just not enough air.
Air.
Air, good. In the world...
In the world.
In the world.
In the world. A little bit harder on the R.
In the world.
Yeah, that's you're getting there. That's good. That's right. Air in the world to suit me.
Air in the world to suit me.
To suit me?
That was good pickup on that, Nathan, because what you did was sort of a semi-liquid U after the S, which is great, but not an over-rounding of the lips. This is how I'd work with the actors, because we're not trying to over-round lips. That's why we have words like do and to and you, rather than do and to and you. Yeah. Great. So the world to suit me, and there never has been.
And there never has been.
And there never has been.
Right. So let's try the line. The problem is there's just not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been.
All right. So, Nathan, I'll go first. The problem is there's just not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been.
Great start.
Would you give me another one to mock it off of?
The problem is there's just not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been.
The problem is there's not...
Not enough?
Not enough.
Yeah, it's a spillage from not into enough, not enough.
Not enough air in the world to suit me, and there never has been.
Right.
Fantastic. You're good at this, Turner. You're very good. All right, and unfortunately, there's not enough time in the segment
not
to
enough,
keep going.
Never enough time.
Gary Logan is the resident dialects coach at the Everyman Theater. Their production of Outside Mullingar runs through January 10th. We've got more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
You're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. In a severe thunderstorm, you might hear somebody say, it's raining cats and dogs. Well, in the United States, even in the sunniest of weather, it really is raining cats and dogs. More homes in the United States have cats and dogs than have kids. There are more than four times as many feline and canine residents of American homes than there were in the 1960s, nearly 150 million. one of them for every two of us. Baltimore-based writer David Grimm has taken a look at how the status of our animals in our homes and in our society has changed over time. He's condensed what he's learned into a book called Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. I spoke with David Grimm last year. One of the points you make early on is that cats and dogs are kind of in a category by themselves, as opposed to horses and birds and fish. Why is that?
Well, it's just in terms of not only the amount of money we spend on them. We're projected to spend $60 billion on our pets this year, which trumps the economies of about half the world's countries. But so in our homes, we've certainly singled out these animals more than any other pet. In fact, five times more homes have cats and dogs than have any other pet combined. So in our homes, we've definitely embraced them as members of the family. But also what I want to get into the book is also in the of the law, these two pets have more rights and protections than any other animal in the country. There's felony anti-cruelty laws in every state that protect cats and dogs. Fines can be up to 10 years in prison and $125,000 in fines. Cats and dogs can inherit money, which they couldn't do about 15 years ago. And there are emotional distress damages now that owners can qualify for in some courts, where if somebody kills your cat or a dog or severely injures them, you can get sometimes up to tens of thousands of dollars. And typically those damages are only available for spouses or children. Cats and dogs have even been the subject of custody battles.
Yeah.
So there's just a lot of things going on around these two animals that just shows what a remarkable status they've achieved in our society.
I mean, you trace this history, you know, to ancient times through the present, but cats and dogs have always seemed to have some sort of elevated status in many societies. I mean, even in the 19th century, you talk about how Charles Darwin thought that dogs were capable of abstract thought and even morality and language. So people have always attributed, quite a few... talents to dogs and cats.
Yeah, they've kind of been on this roller coaster ride. Dogs were the very first thing we ever domesticated. They probably came into our society somewhere between 15 and 30,000 years ago. Cats about 10,000 years ago. And at first, they weren't really like the family members we see them as today. They were kind of co-workers. Dogs helped us hunt and herd, and cats protected our crops. And it was a very sort of tit-for-tat relationship. You do this for me, and I'll do this for you. There wasn't a whole lot of thinking about pets or companions. And that's sort of more of a recent phenomenon. In the Middle Ages, though, cats and dogs, it wasn't a great time to be anybody in the Middle Ages, but it wasn't a great time to be a cat or a dog. They were blamed for spreading plague and death and disease. And it's really only been in the last 150 years or so where they really started to become companions and then bona fide family members.
So the book sort of traces the evolution of dogs and cats from objects to then personal property, objects that could be owned, to family members, as you say, and then to finally even to perhaps legal citizens.
That's right. And what's really fascinating, speaking of a roller coaster ride, 100 years ago, cats and dogs weren't even property. I talk about one of my favorite anecdotes in the book is this Baltimore case from 1894 that was reported in The Sun, where in the Canton neighborhood, a man actually sneaks into a woman's yard, steals her cat. He's brought before a judge, and the judge can't charge him for a crime because cats and dogs at the time were not considered property. They were considered so legally worthless that they weren't even considered property, so the judge had to let the man go. That's obviously changed as pets became members of our family. They became property, and I argue in the book they're the most valuable animal property or the most valuable animals in the country. But yeah, that line is now starting to blur even between property and person. Cats and dogs are technically property, but with all these things like custody cases and emotional distress damages and felony anti-cruelty laws, cats and dogs more than any other animal are really blurring that line between property in person and animal in person, not just in our homes, but also in the courts.
Let's talk a little bit about Henry Berg, who's the founder of the ASPCA, the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in New York. He did this in the middle of the 1800s. It's his work that really started establishing this notion that, you know, dogs and cats were a value in some way.
That's right. And actually, his original focus was on horses. Horses were horribly treated in the turn of the 20th century in New York. Before automobiles, the horses were run to death on the streets. And so his original concern came from horses, and that was when really a lot of his primary efforts with the ASPCA. They actually had their own police force on the New York streets that would bus people that were committing animal cruelty. And soon after he died, when the horses started to disappear because the automobile came in, then the residents of New York noticed this big problem with homeless cats and dogs. They were dying on the streets. raids. They were being rounded up and very cruelly executed by pounds at the time. And so the ASPCA stepped in, and what was once a mission to protect horses became a mission really to protect cats and dogs. And that still really remains their primary mission today.
And it's the irony that you point out is that they're legally protected before they were even really recognized as things of personal value.
That's right. A lot of this stuff happened before cats and dogs were considered legal property. When they were considered legally worthless, you could steal a cat or a dog, you could kill a cat or a dog, nothing would happen to you. But if you were cruel to a cat or a dog, then you might get punished. And it was a misdemeanor at the time. Now it's a felony, which just shows, again, how the status of these animals has evolved.
David Grimm's book is called Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You talk about a court case, custody. Stanley and Linda Perkins had a dog that they loved very much. They didn't, however, end up loving each other all that much, so they divorced. And they ended up spending $146,000 in legal fees to determine the custody of their dog. Was it a dog or a cat?
It was a dog. Remember. It was a dog named Gigi. I think it was maybe a greyhound mix. This was in San Diego in around 2000. And it was, I think, and it may remain the most expensive pet custody battle in U.S. history. And what's really fascinating about a lot of these custody battles, and they've become a lot more common even since then, is that you'll often have a judge saying, okay, the man and the woman are fighting over the dog or cat, and I'm going to decide what is in the best interest of this animal. What home would the cat be happiest in? What home would the dog be happiest in? Kind of like you would do for human children. So that's a really remarkable thing, because you wouldn't do that for a toaster. You wouldn't say, what home would the toaster be happiest in? So again, it's a recognition that these animals aren't just property, that they really are family members.
Leona Helmsley in 2007 rather famously left about $12 million to her dog. The moral implications of that are something we'll discuss at another time. But even before that, in 1968, a woman named Thelma Russell left her estate to a friend and her dog, and it was upheld. I mean, so this is the point when pets are now starting to be seen as people?
Right. So before 2000, it wasn't actually legal to leave money to animals, including cats or dogs. Sometimes judges would allow it, as in the case that you mentioned. But after 2000, something was adopted called the Uniform Trust Code, which a lot of states, in fact, the majority of states now have versions of, which does allow you to leave money to cats and dogs and actually other animals as well. And it's really remarkable because technically, cats and dogs are still property, and money is property. So property shouldn't be able to inherit property. And this sort of violates hundreds of years of property law. But it's a law now in most states that you can leave money to your animals. And again, you know, it just really shows that when owners are really treating their pets like children, they're saying, if I die, I want somebody to be able to take care of my cat or my dog. I want to be able to leave money for them. And the law is upholding that.
Well, David Grimm, it's a fascinating read. Thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Author David Grimm. His book is called Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. We've got a link to more about the book on our website. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. And that will do it for us here on Maryland Morning. Stay tuned for midday at noon. We'll be back again bright and early Wednesday, right after Morning Edition, right here on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.